You can turn in your Bibles to Genesis 37. Genesis chapter 37. We overviewed Joseph's life last week. This week we will get through this first chapter. We're going to read the entire chapter. I will stop and give a few explanatory comments as we go. Genesis 37, verse 1. Now Jacob lived in the land where his father had sojourned, in the land of Canaan. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought back a bad report about his brothers to his father. Notice, of course, that Joseph is only 17, and his brothers are at least late 20s and 30s, several of his brothers. So this is a very, very difficult situation for him. And knowing what we know about his brothers, we can be quite certain that Joseph is not making up something that he's tattling about here, but his brothers almost certainly deserve the bad report that he passes along to his father. Verse 3, now Israel, Jacob, loved Joseph more than all his sons, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a varicolored tunic. Joseph is Jacob's favorite because, it says, he is the son of his old age. What does that mean? Well, I think three things. One, he's literally the son of his later years, which partly endears him to him. Secondly, he is the son of his favorite wife, which sounds bad, but you do have to remember that Jacob only chose one of his two wives, and the other was forced upon him. So this is the child of Rachel. But I think more importantly than either of those things, the key characteristic, differentiating characteristic of Jacob's later years was that he was finally humbled before the Lord and stepped up as a spiritual leader in his home. And so Joseph, along with Benjamin, was the child who really benefited from that, and you see the result. What was the result of a dad who finally humbled himself before the Lord and really became a man dependent on the Lord and a spiritual leader in his home? The result was Joseph, and that ought to be an encouragement to all of you, because there are some of you who say, you know, I've been a pretty crummy dad in terms of my spiritual leadership in my home. Is it hopeless for me? Well, Joseph ought to assure you that it's not hopeless. And with Joseph's brothers, obviously, we will see in this chapter a constant concern to dad. It's no wonder that Joseph is a favorite. When Joseph is a joy, I mean, you know, you can imagine what it's like. Some of you know what it's like to have a 17-year-old that really loves the Lord, and the joy that is. And then all these other kids that are a grief to his heart, and so no surprise that Joseph is a favorite. Now, verses 4 through 11. His brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, so they hated him. And they could not speak to him on friendly terms. Then Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, "Please listen to this dream which I have had. For behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf rose up and also stood erect, and behold, your sheaves gathered around and bowed down to my sheaf." Then his brothers said to him, "Are you actually going to reign over us? Or are you really going to rule over us?" So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. Now he had still another dream, and related it to his brothers, and said, "Lo, I have had still another dream. And behold, the sun and the moon and 11 stars were bowing down to me." He related it to his father and to his brothers, and his father rebuked. And that's a strong word, very strong word, that has the implication of yelling at him. His father rebuked him and said to him, "What is this dream that you have had? Shall I and your mother and your brothers actually come to bow ourselves down before you to the ground?" His brothers were jealous of him, but notice this, his father kept the saying in mind. So his forceful rebuke was partly a show, I think, for the other brothers to see. I just want us to notice at this point that these dreams must be God-given because they come true. And we will see over in chapter 43, it records that when his brothers see him in Egypt, not yet knowing who he is, it says when Joseph came home, they brought into the house to him the present which was in their hand, that's his brothers, and they bowed to the ground before him. So it literally happened in the Joseph's office or whatever in Egypt. His family came and bowed down before him. So these are God-given dreams, though I don't think Joseph knows that now. I think he will not know that until he sees later what happens. Now verses 12 through 14, then his brothers went to pasture their father's flock in Shechem. Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock in Shechem? Come, and I will send you to them." And he said to him, "I will go." Then he said to him, "Go now and see about the welfare of your brothers and the welfare of the flock, and bring word back to me." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. Jacob is concerned about his kids who are running away from God, and Jacob is not at all wise to send his 17-year-old favorite son into that situation. But the thing I want you to notice is Joseph's obedience. You're seeing the beginning of a man's life who was characterized by obedience. Obedience to dad, obedience to God. He was a submitted man who obeyed. Even though at 17, surely Joseph knew he was not walking into the best situation going to check on his older brothers. Verse 15, a man found him, and behold, he was wandering in the field. And the man asked him, "What are you looking for?" He said, "I'm looking for my brothers. Please tell me where they're pasturing the flock." And the man said, "They've moved from here, for I heard them say, 'Let us go to Dothan.'" So Joseph went after his brothers, found them at Dothan. When they saw him from a distance, and before he came close to him, they plotted against him to put him to death. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now then, come and let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. And we'll say, 'A wild beast devoured him.' Then let us see what will become of his dreams." But Reuben heard this and rescued him out of their hands and said, "Let us not take his life." Reuben further said to them, "Shed no blood, throw him into this pit that is in the wilderness, but do not lay hands on him, that he might rescue him out of their hands to restore him to his father." So it came about when Joseph reached his brothers that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the very colored tunic that was on him, and they took him and threw him into the pit. Now the pit was empty without any water in it. So the initial plan is to kill him and then throw him into one of these cisterns that they used to hold water for their flocks. But they just end up throwing him down into a cistern that is empty, in essence, kind of putting him in their own little prison. Verse 25, then they sat down to eat a meal. And as they raised their eyes and looked, behold, a caravan of Ishmaelites was coming from Gilead with their camels bearing aromatic gum and balm and myrrh on their way to bring them down to Egypt. Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us to kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites and not lay our hands on him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brother listened to him. Then some Midianite traders passed by, so they pulled him up and lifted Joseph out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. Thus they brought Joseph into Egypt. It's a little confusing there, but Midianites and Ishmaelites are the same people. Midianites is the more narrow word. Ishmaelites is just a general word they use for their Israel's wandering cousin. So that's the same people in verse 28. And they are headed down a very common trade route from northern Palestine or Syria, carrying these herbal remedies from the rosin of these plants that they're taking down to Egypt to trade and sell. And so with their brother in this empty pit, they decide, Judah says, why not make a profit off of this? And they sell him. Verse 29, now Reuben returned to the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, so he tore his garments. He returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is not there. As for me, where am I to go?" So they took Joseph's tunic and slaughtered a male goat, dipped the tunic in blood, and they sent the varicolored tunic and brought it to their father and said, "We found this. Please examine it to see whether it's your son's tunic or not." Then he examined it and said, "It is my son's tunic. A wild beast has devoured him. Joseph has surely been torn to pieces." So Jacob tore his clothes and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. Then all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him. But he refused to be comforted, and he said, "Surely I will go down to Sheol in mourning for my son." So his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, Pharaoh's officer, the captain of the bodyguard. And we would do well to notice two things. One is Jesus too was sold by one who hated him. And secondly, we would do well to remember that there are hundreds of thousands of people around the world who have been sold and are in the bondage of slavery today. Tricked into it many times, forced into it other times. And if you read the story On your weekly sheet this week, you'll read about a man in Pakistan, representative of many Christians in Pakistan, who are basically slaves in the brick-making factories in Pakistan. This man, since I think it says 1937 or something, has made bricks in this brick-making factory in Pakistan. My wife and I were laying in bed the other night and discussing what time the girls would wake up in the morning, and one of us said, well, regardless, I think we'll make it. And I thought, you know, we've got brothers and sisters in Pakistan who have been working in brick kilns, slaves to Muslim masters for 70 years. Yeah, I think we'll make it if our kids wake up at 5:30 instead of 6. We'll probably be all right. There are literally slaves many places around the world today, and many of them Christians. Now, when you think about Genesis 37 in the big picture, that we saw last week, you know that God is up to a lot of important things in Joseph's life, in this family, and ultimately in what will become a great nation in Egypt. Backstage passes are really popular today, like contests and stuff you hear on the radio and in stores. You can win the opportunity to go backstage for this whatever entertainment thing or music program or whatever it is. Well, the Bible really gives you, in essence, backstage pass to the reality of what's going on in the world. And we know from what the Bible tells us that behind the scenes, backstage, in Genesis 37, God is providentially accomplishing a lot of important things. And we saw that last week when we overviewed Joseph's life. But on the surface of Genesis 37, on stage, so to speak, which is often very different from the behind-the-scenes reality. On stage, what we see is a big dose of human nature. This is one of those chapters that's like looking in a mirror. We see here reflections of our own nature. And we need this because, well, I can chew gum, and it doesn't bother me at all. I can eat food and it doesn't bother me at all. However, I have this, if you sit behind me in church and chew gum and smack gum, I will probably go screaming out of the room. It drives me so crazy. But if I chew gum, not a problem. Now, isn't that the way we are? If it's in ourselves, it doesn't bother us at all. But as soon as we see it in somebody else, we see it for what it really is. Though there's nothing wrong with chewing gum. It's just something in my brain. I'm strange. So when you look at Genesis 37, you see sinful human tendencies in these people, which we have to admit are reflected in our own hearts too often. But for some reason, we see them more clearly in others than in ourselves, and that's helpful. And backstage, we see God at work doing great things, while on stage, we see human nature. So let's see what we can learn about ourselves and then about God here. So first of all, human nature on display. We'll start with Jacob. In Jacob, we see, in a sense, our tendency to favoritism, but in a sense, it's our tendency to try to force what God is already going to do. We've already talked about some good reasons why Jacob felt a special bond with Joseph, but that wasn't an excuse for the favoritism that tore their family apart even more. And don't you think Jacob, of all people, Jacob would know what favoritism can do to a family? It was his parents that played favorites and tore their family apart in the process. But Jacob has not learned and repeats the same mistake. He gives Joseph this coat of many colors, which, frankly, it's unlikely that there are many colors involved. This is almost certainly a full-length robe that comes down to wrists and ankles and indicated superiority because it was not the kind of robe you would wear for work. So it said, you guys work, and I'm more important than that. So it just was an indication that this is the son that has my blessing. This is the son that will receive the inheritance. This is the son God has chosen to lead this family. And in his favoritism, I think Jacob is trying to force what God's already going to do. Then in Joseph, dare I say that there might be some pride here in Joseph? See, there's this thing that Bible scholars like to say Joseph is a type of Christ. And because he's a type of Christ, we're not allowed to see any sin in Joseph. But Joseph's human. And so I think that here in this chapter we see our tendency to spiritual pride. At best, he's very naive. But more realistically, he sees what happens when he shares the dream the first time. So even if sharing the dream the first time was naivety, sharing the dream the second time is not naivety. There has got to be a little sense of spiritual superiority going on here. And if you have a child who has risen above their peers in spiritual maturity, you know all about this. You have to fight against the sense of spiritual superiority. You've got to remind them that pride is as much a sin as cheating and stealing. You have to point them to Christ as the standard by which they're to compare themselves, not other people. You have to remind them that any good thing in them is the result of God's grace. It's a lot of work to keep someone who's growing in spiritual maturity as a young person, to keep them in their place and not thinking more highly of themselves than they ought to think. So I think we see a hint of that in Joseph. But for those things that we see in Jacob and Joseph, those are, humanly speaking, a joke compared to what we see in Joseph's brothers. Because in Joseph's brothers, we see a huge amount of pride, jealousy, greed, manipulation, and violence. And frankly, those who are walking in rebellion against the Lord will often turn against those who are walking in submission to the Lord. That's just the way it is. It happens in churches. People start to grow. Some people are submitting their hearts to the Lord and growing. Other people are saying, no, 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 no. I'm going to do what I want to do. And guess what happens? The people who aren't growing start to pick at the people who are and criticize. You see that big Bible he brings? He just brings that big Bible because he thinks he's more spiritual than the rest of us. Oh, come on. We do things like pick at people for their Bible size. But that's the kind of thing that's going on here. It happens in families. You get kids that are growing and other kids that aren't, and guess what? It happens in Christian colleges where you have kids whose hearts are submitted to the Lord and they want to grow in the Lord and other kids who aren't. And the kids who are trying to obey the Lord get scorned by those who aren't. This is really normal. Really normal. And guess what? It started with the first family. Abel said, I want to do what God wants me to do. Cain said, I want to do my own thing. Abel got God's blessing, Cain got ticked, and killed him. The first family. What was it? Spiritual jealousy. That's all it was. Their pride and their jealousy rears its head, first of all, when Joseph receives this coat of honor. Then it gets stoked by the dreams that suggest that at some point they might be in submission to Joseph. You know, it's just part of our sinful human nature. We hate to see somebody else get ahead. Isn't it amazing? It's just a line at the grocery store, and they open a new register, and the people behind me rush before me. That's not fair. I should be over there in first in line. I'm stuck at the back of this line, and they're up in that line. Or you're coming down, you know, you take that 215 to 15 merge, and you're in that lane waiting to get off at Winchester Road, and it's Friday night, and it's backed all the way up to the please beware, because cars may stop in front of you light, and you wait and wait and wait and wait, and right when you get to the front, boom, there comes that little white Corvette and cuts right in front of you. I can't believe you didn't wait in line. I waited in line, and he got in front of me, and that's not fair. Isn't it amazing how there can be all kinds of sin in the world, and we don't care? But as soon as somebody cuts in front of us in line, man, our sense of justice, we are the kings of justice. Justice has got to be done. Just the suggestion that Joseph might be more important, or that they might have to submit to Joseph, just uncovers the depth of their pride. And they respond with jealousy, with hatred, and ultimately with selling their brother into slavery. It's not just that we hate seeing others get ahead, we also hate submission. And the dreams suggest that they might actually have to yield to Joseph at some point. We don't like submission to the IRS. We don't like submission to the Highway Patrol. We don't like submission to the Homeowners Association regulations. We don't like submission in marriage. We don't like submission to church leadership. We don't like submission to our employers. We just don't like anybody telling us what to do. And this is ultimately mankind's problem. We all want to be king. We all want to be sovereign of the universe. The problem is there's only one. That spot's already taken. But we all try. And our problems with human authority are just a symptom of our problem with God's authority. We don't like being told what to do. So the combination of we hate to see somebody else get ahead and we hate to have to submit to anybody else, you see that in their pride and in their jealousy. And then verse 26 astounds me. Judas said to his brothers, "What profit is it for us?" Verse 27, "Come and let us sell him." These guys are making their decisions about whether to kill their brother or not based on profit. That's pretty low. But there's a reason why the Bible warns us against falling in love with money and things, because they can get that kind of grip on your heart. The Bible never warns against having money and things. It warns against falling in love with those money and things, because they can grip your heart to the point where you'll take your brother's life or not take his life based on whether you'll make a profit off of it. These brothers, well, that's exactly what James 4 told us that we looked at last week. It's our selfish desires. It's our greed that wrecks our relationships. So these brothers are caught up in pride and jealousy, greed and selfishness. And in the end, verse 35, all his sons arose to comfort him. "Oh, Dad, we're so sorry this happened to Joseph." Yeah. That's, I don't know which point is lower, deciding to not kill their brother for profit or fake comforting their father. Now, what's the solution to this human nature that's on display there and in our own hearts? It is knowing God and trusting His providence. I know I'm not going to win Most Profound Preacher of the Year award for this point, but that's not really my job anyways. Knowing God and trusting His providence is a solution. When you have a small view of God, when you don't really know God, you don't trust Him, and you're not confident whether or not He really knows what He's doing. But the Bible teaches, through stories like this one, that God directs all things to fulfill His purposes. Remember that from last week? God's providence. He directs all things to fulfill His purposes. And we have a big God who sits on the throne of the universe with perfect authority and power. And even in the sinful world, He directs all things to fulfill His promises. So the really big, profound point from Genesis 37 is you've got to trust God. He knows what He's doing. He's a God of providence. And I put on your sheet a book I would recommend to you by Jerry Bridges. It's called Trusting God Even When Life Hurts. Excellent book. You can get it for $10 off Amazon, or if you want to really be cheap, you can get it for $3 used off Amazon. It will be well worth your $3 or $10. It is excellent. Strongly encourage you to get it. The human nature on display in this chapter shows a lack of knowledge of God and confidence in Him. Let's talk through those people again. Jacob and Joseph. Jacob and Joseph needed to leave things in God's hands. Jacob knows that God's hand is on this son in a special way, but he feels like he's got to force it by putting Joseph up on a pedestal. And all he does is cause problems when he tries to do that. Much better would have been to rest in God's providence. And Joseph doesn't need to tell the world. God's going to do what He's going to do. Psalm 75, 6 and 7 says, "Not from the east, nor from the west, nor from the desert comes exaltation. But God is the judge. He puts down one and He exalts another." They didn't need to force anything. Just rest in God, in a God of providence. You remember Jacob's grandmother Sarah? She knew the promise of God that she was going to have a child. But she wasn't sure if God could really be trusted. So she came up with this scheme to send in her servant to Abraham, and maybe God needs my help to make this happen. Remember Jacob's mother, Rebecca, who knew that Jacob was the chosen child, but she wasn't so sure if God could really make sure he got the birthright and the blessing, so she was going to help him, and she came up with a scheme and a plan and some lies and manipulation to make sure that what God was going to do anyways happened. Did any of that need to happen? Did Sarah need to pull off that scheme of giving her husband yet another wife? Did Rebecca need to lie and cheat and deceive her husband? Did Jacob need to put Joseph up on a pedestal? No. None of that helped anything. It just caused problems. God will accomplish His good and perfect will without our manipulation and scheming to help Him out. But the brothers obviously needed to trust God. There's a staggering irony in the story. They see indication that God's blessing is on Joseph, and they hate that, and they want to fight that. But in the end, God's blessing on Joseph is going to be the very thing that saves their lives. So in their failure to trust God, in their scheming and manipulation and fighting, they're actually, you could say they're trying to take their own lives. Because humanly speaking, if they would have succeeded, that's what would have happened. They should have simply trusted God. Now here's the bottom line. When their father shows favoritism to Joseph, they should have said, I'll let God take care of that. He knows what's best. When Joseph shared these dreams with them, they should have said, God knows what he's doing. If Joseph's just making this up, then I don't need to worry about it. And if God's involved here, then I'm going to let God do whatever he knows is best. That's it. And this is what I'm exhorting you to today. React to people and react to the situations in your life with a calm confidence in the Lord. He directs all things to fulfill His purposes. And what's on stage might be scary, but behind the scenes, God knows what He's doing. Jacob's father Isaac tried to fight God's purposes by forcing the blessing on Esau. It didn't work. Jacob's brother Esau tried to fight God's blessing on Jacob. Planned to kill him. Didn't work. Your arms are too short to box with God, someone said. Just a simple trust in God's providence was what was needed. You can look at a little chart I put in your notes. When our focus is on ourselves, our primary question is, what do I want? We are imprisoned by our desires. And the result in our relationships and life is things like jealousy, strife, manipulation. Because I'm not the king of the universe and life was not meant to revolve around me. And when I try to make myself the center of the universe, it doesn't work. But when our focus turns to God, we are then eager to see what God is doing in each situation. We look past what's on stage and we say behind the scenes, what is God doing? That sets us free to love others, to obey, to have peace in our hearts. It is bondage to live a self-focused life. It's like being in prison because the whole world doesn't revolve around you. Everybody doesn't always do what you want them to do. Everything doesn't go the way you want it to go. And when life revolves around me, my life is full of misery. Jealousy and strife and selfish ambition are the result, James says. When I get my focus on what's God doing, you're freed from that. To love people. Wouldn't it have been great if there would have been just a hint of love somewhere in Genesis 37? But when your focus is on yourself, you're not free to love anybody else because everybody else has to get in line for you and what you want to make your life happy. Go with me over to 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians chapter 4. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 8. This is in Paul's autobiography, 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians 4, 8. We are afflicted in every way, but not crushed. Perplexed, but not despairing. Persecuted, but not forsaken. Struck down, but not destroyed. Always carrying about in the body the dying of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our body. For we who live are constantly being delivered over to death for Jesus' sake, so that the life of Jesus also may be manifested in our mortal flesh. So death works in us, but life in you. Now go to verse 16. Therefore we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed day by day. For momentary light affliction is producing for us an eternal weight of glory far beyond all comparison. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. You notice that Paul says his life could be characterized by words like afflicted in every way, perplexed, persecuted, struck down, decaying. And he says it's almost like he's always dying. That's how hard life is. Okay? That was what was on stage. That was what was on display in his life. That was what you saw. But he says, I am not crushed, despairing, forsaken, But to the contrary, my inner man is being renewed day by day. Why? Verse 18. Because I don't look at what's on stage. We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Simply, rather than looking at the details, the circumstances, the people of life, he says, I'm looking at all that saying, what's God doing? What's God doing? Earlier I said, in Genesis 37, there are two levels. What God's doing behind the scenes, and what human nature is doing on stage. And the same thing's true in your lives. There is the stuff of life on the surface, the details that are happening in your life right now. But behind that, there's a God of providence at work in your life. And so the question is, which one are you focused on? Are you focused on your desires and how the people around you are messing things up and what's on stage in your life is not going the way you want it to go? Or are you focused on the God who's at work directing all things for His good purposes? We look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. Look back at that chart one more time. You can live enslaved by a focus on yourself and what you want, and live with jealousy, strife, anger, manipulation, maybe even violence. Your circumstances will toss you around like a canoe in the ocean. That's what life's like when you're focused on yourself. Or you can live trusting God, looking for the good things He's doing, resting in His providence, which can always be trusted. And the result will be love for others, obedience toward God, and peace. Peace in your heart, like we talked about last week. Let's pray. Father, I pray that You would turn the hearts of this group of people to look not at the things which are seen, but the things that are not seen. And Father, there are some here that are just beaten down by the circumstances of life, and I pray for Your grace to lift up their eyes, to trust in and rest in and rejoice in a God who's directing all good things, all things for His good purposes. And Father, there may be people here that are focused on themselves and really are miserable, and life's a mess. There's a lot of strife. There's contention and not love and just struggles. And I pray that You would turn their focus to the God who can be trusted. And Father, I know that in many ways my heart turns to self-focus. And even this week, many times, I was agitated because the world wasn't revolving around me like I wanted it to. Father, will You forgive me for that? And turn my heart to trust You and just rest in what You're doing around me and in the people around me. Father, give us, build in us a calm confidence in providence for Your glory in our lives. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.